Hi, I'm Rachel.
And I'm Matt.
Welcome to the Strange and Beautiful Book Club. Our book club episode, our Tuesday, mostly, book club episode. We are going to talk about God Killer by Hannah Kaner. I'm going to go Kaner.
Yeah.
Because there's only one end, N. There's only one end also, but we were supposed to do The Clockwork Orange. I read the first chapter of A Clockwork Orange, and I thought if I read the rest of that, I was probably going to die. Plus, there was a introduction by the author that was like, y'all, this is the worst book that I have ever written. Why the fuck will you not let it go? And I was like, you know what?
I'll let it go. I heard all about it.
I'll let it go for you. I'll do it. No problem. So anyway, I have a copy of Clockwork Orange for sale. Just kidding. It was like any time we get over than 20%, like greater than 20% made up words, I can't do it. So, I had to bail. So we decided to do God Killer instead because I just read it and I thought it was really good. And I think this is a really good example of how not every good fantasy book has to be 900 pages long.
Yeah, this is much shorter.
Oh, it's quite short.
I think less, just under 300 pages.
The sequel is just as short. It's short but dense.
288.
Yeah, I was recommending it to someone and I described it as it's extremely dense prose. Like, it's good. It is edited down to, like, it's honed. It is everything that needs to be in there is in there. And even with 288, parts of it drag. So I'm really glad that, like, you know,
it's concise.
I love a chunky book just as much as anybody else, but they don't all need to be like that. And actually, it turns people off from reading. Like, if you buy the physical copies of Sarah J. Maas just to throw it out at random for no particular reason, you notice she starts out right around the length of God Killer, and then her most recent books are all just like these 900 to 1,000 page long that need to be 500 pages long. Like, they half of it is just chaff that could just be cut. And it's because people are like, oh, I want a long book. Well, sometimes you need a long book, and sometimes 288 is perfectly fine. So that's why we are reading God Killer. And we're going to try out a little bit of a different format. So what we're going to do is the first section of this podcast is going to be spoiler-free. So if you're just looking for a book recommendation, we're going to recommend the shit out of this book. And then we will warn you when we wander into spoiler land, and you can turn it off and come back or, you know, listen, whatever you want to do. So I guess we could just get started.
All right.
So I made you read this book.
Okay. Hold on. I thought we didn't do the intro.
No, we did already. We started with it.
Gotcha.
It's because it's so smooth. We just went. And I used to say, let's just get into it. And then we'd go, hi, I'm Rachel. So you had a flashback. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's okay. I made you read this book. What do you think? Just off the top.
I liked it.
You liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminded me a little bit of Name of the Wind. As far as it's, you know, standard medieval-ish high fantasy world building
setting, yeah.
Yeah. And we start out with an orphaned child.
Yeah. I mean, it is and it isn't. Like, it's standard fantasy, but also I feel like it's a world on the cusp of an industrial revolution.
Right.
Because we have a lot of industry, we talk a lot about trades, and it's like, these are the paper makers, these are the dye makers, this is the, you know, it just has a...
Yeah, it has a...
I found the setting very
pre-industrial revolution feel to
pre, but close, like pre, but close. Not every single isolated village has its scribe who does everything, but there are people who are specialized.
Right, and most of the people are, like, there's kind of a standard education
yeah
level that everybody's at, which is, I guess, indicative of more connected society.
Yeah, I was going to say we have a world where you can specialize. You don't need to grow your own food and have your trade. You can go to the market and buy goods and then go back to your job where you make ink all day. And I thought that was a really, and also her naming convention is very unusual. We get a lot of like I feel like there's a fantasy sound. Like we get a lot of names.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, or hold. Like, for example, since we're on Sarah J. Maas, like Rift Hold, Selena. There's like a very, there's a sound. You know what I mean? Like if you read a lot of fantasy, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's the fantasy names. Yeah. And I feel like we've all just been copying Lord of the Rings for just like.
We've been ripping off Lord of the Rings for decades.
Centuries. Yeah. However long. And this is very, we're not. We have a lot of hard consonant names. They are not soft names, which I really liked. Like the main character's name is Kissin. And then there's Elo, but his name is really Elogast. And like Skedi, his real name is
Skediseth.
Skediseth. Yeah, there's a lot of very, it felt almost, I don't want to say German. It just felt like not your standard fantasy nomenclature, which I really enjoyed because it made it feel very unique. And it was a real simple thing for her to do, which was just come up with names I've never heard before. And yeah, I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, but then the writing is good.
Yeah.
I don't think I found any like grammar or spelling errors. So it's been well edited. And plot wise, and it kind of pulls you right through. There's not really any wasted writing.
There's not a ton of wasted
filler stuff.
Yeah. Which I really like. The first part I feel drags a little, and it's only because our characters are all in separate places and we're bringing them together. So it's our fantasy bringing the party together moment.
Right.
And I think the only reason that felt slow is because we were switching, because we have quite a few characters we're bringing together. Because we have Kissin, we have Inara and her little buddy, Skedi, and then we have Elo. And we're bringing the three of them together. So we're giving each one of them their motivation. And that takes a while.
Right. And it really doesn't feel forced.
It doesn't. No. I feel like everybody came together in a very... I never felt like I was watching the author drive the characters to get them together. I always felt like, oh, we're doing the thing that I felt like would be next. Yeah. And we really start off with quite a bang. Like if we just want to... This isn't a spoiler really, but at the very beginning... we meet Kissin or Kissena, who generally goes by Kissin, and she is Talishan.
Right. So this is the prologue?
Yeah, this is the prologue where we find out that she's from Talisha. She's from this small fishing village in the north, which is basically Scotland because she's got red hair freckles.
If the continent is England.
Yeah.
Then this is Scotland.
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
the cold mountainous north.
It's the north. And they're culturally distinct. They have their own language. They're a separate country. She is from another country, from the country that is the setting for most of the book.
Midrin.
Yeah. And so her father and mother had a thruple with the water god or / sea god. Thruple in that the sea god was in love with her father. And Ocitizen is his name. And they are being burned alive because Kissin's country of Talisha is slowly falling under the religious sway of like a big fire god named Haseth. And the cool thing about this world is gods are a very real, organic, and changing part of everybody's lives. So gods can appear through human intent. So anytime you have enough intent... A god can appear. So say you have a bunch of sailors who all want to be safe, you might have the god of safe sailing appear. And then you can feed that god with prayers and offerings, and they get bigger. And the more you feed them and the bigger they get, the more powers they get. So they literally need faith in order to grow and become more powerful. And I thought that was a really cool thing, but also they are mortal. They are right. Functionally immortal, but they can be killed, which is what Kissin is. Kissin is a god killer.
Right. This reminded me a little bit of American Gods, where you have all of the mythological gods, whatever, and they can like manifest physically. But that particular like instance of the manifestation of like Odin, who's one of the characters in American Gods, it is like produced by the collective belief of a group of people.
Yeah.
And so there's an instance of Odin that's in Europe, but then there's another instance of Odin in America.
Right.
And they are different versions of Odin.
Yeah, sort of like that, except they all have different names and they're different things.
Right. Yeah. This is a more organic feel to that idea that just a collection, a big enough collection of people believing similar kinds of things produces bloop, a god.
Yeah. And we aren't locked into any kind of a previously established mythology. This isn't like Romans and Greeks where like the Romans were like, oh, those gods are cool. We're just going to snatch them and rename them. And right. suddenly Hades is Mars and so on and so forth. But it's more like a she literally, Hannah came up with like her own everything. Like,
yeah.
I didn't feel like this big was a carbon building. Copy of, yeah, she got big world building energy. Like, I never felt like, oh, this is derivative. Oh, that's from this. Oh, that's from this. And can we talk about the disability representation in this?
Yes, this is probably the most diverse cast in a fantasy story that I've ever read.
Yeah, so Kissin at the very beginning, choose her way out of these ropes to try to save her family because her family is being sacrificed to Hiseth. Because one of the things that can happen to a god over time is the offerings will grow bigger. And sometimes that means you get bigger gold, you get bigger chunks of hair or whatever. And sometimes it means sacrifice people to me.
It reminds me of addiction, like the addiction spiral.
Yeah.
Where you want that feeling, but now you need more of the thing to get the same thrill.
Yeah.
And the gods are susceptible to that.
Right. And sometimes your addiction is reading a really good book, and sometimes it's heroin. And like, there's a big difference between the repercussions of that. And so Hiseth, which is taking over the Talishan, who is slowly, I mean, they're polytheist. Just because there's literally just hundreds and hundreds of gods. But the problem is when one god gets too big, it's sort of like a snowball rolling downhill. And that's what we're working with Hiseth and Talisha. And so nobody wants anybody who serves Ocitisen anymore. And it's known that her family is entangled with Ocitisen because her father's in love with him. And so they're going to be sacrificed. In love with it? It's a he.
Oh, Ocitisen is a he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're biffles.
It was assigned male at creation.
At manifestation.
Yeah. His statue, which in the second book we find a statue of a citizen, is male. So we'll go male.
Cool.
And she refers to a citizen as he.
Yeah, and they're Kissin and her siblings are all named after ocean stuff.
Yeah.
In honor of Ocitisen.
Right. And so her family's being burned alive. She chews her way out of these ropes and she actually loses a tooth. And if the fact that she legit chews herself out of these ropes doesn't give you a clue as to Kissin's character, you're welcome because she's such a, I love Kissin so much because she's purely motivated by spite, which
it resonates with
you. It resonates with me on a visceral level because I'm also motivated by spite.
I agree.
So she has a gold tooth, which I think is really cool because she loses one of her canines at the very beginning. And then this metal cage falls on her leg, like the bottom half of her leg. And her father gets her out, gets her into the sea, and he trades his life for hers.
Well, first he chops her leg off.
Yeah.
To get it free. And then drags her out of the house.
Yeah. Yes, because it's trapped. And she's either going to die or she's going to... Yeah, so she's... missing the part of her leg below the knee on the one leg. And so she wears a prosthetic, which is designed by her blacksmith friend. And she wears it the entire time. She does take it off occasionally. And we even cover, like, her leg still hurts or her leg will itch. Like,
yeah, she's and it never really... It's never really a plot device.
No.
it's really only ever used as this is an aspect of this character.
Right.
And she uses it in a fight one time to block a blade.
It gets hit. Somebody tries to kick
by a blade.
Yeah, somebody tries to cut off her leg and they hit that instead. And she's like, and she just kicks them in the head with her other leg. And yeah, I mean, it's never used as a, I feel like there is a good way to use disability, and there's a lot of also a wide variety of sexual representation in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's a way to use it that just feels like part of the world. And then there's like a, y'all, I'm checking this box. Does anybody have the list? You can check this off the list,
right.
Y'all.
Right. It only ever comes up a few times. And usually it's just as a description.
Yeah.
And it doesn't stop her from doing anything.
Yeah, and nobody lingers on it. Nobody's right. Like, oh, look how brave she is. She's still fighting gods even though she's missing part of her leg. Oh, my God. She's such an inspiration.
Right. Like, there's one point where they're climbing through a dark cave and she's like, she's falling behind a little bit. And she says, it's a little harder for me to scramble over these rocks with my leg.
Right, because she can't feel her foot.
Yeah, just
she's
hold
like,
up
God
for
damn
a
it,
sec.
I can't feel this fucking sucks. I can't feel my foot, but that's fine. I can still kick your ass when we get out of
here.
And
that's the most it ever comes up.
Yeah, that's not inspiration porn. You know, the like, oh, look at how much she's accomplished.
Despite all the tragic things that have happened to her, she just works extra hard to prevail.
And she's scarred. She has a...
has burn scars.
She has burn scars. But also, when you get cursed by a god, you get their writing on you. And so she was cursed by a god of beauty at one point. But she then killed the god of beauty. And so the curse goes away. So she has like a faint mark. It turns white instead of being black. And so she has a white curse mark on her face. She has black god writing on her chest because that's her boon from a citizen that she's never used.
Right.
And she's swarthy and strong and scarred and badass and still desirable to other characters, which I was like, thank fuck. Like, I get so tired. So, okay, I don't know if anybody else listens, but I do have a podcast called Feast, Sheath, and Shatter, which I do with two other ladies, and I have a really good time doing it, and it's super fun, and I enjoy those books, but I get so tired of the thin, pretty, long blonde hair, bright blue eyes, young, but also
wise beyond their years.
Also assassin. No, oh, no, never.
Worldly.
Not, never worldly. Never wise. Only real okay. Good at fighting and real good at killing people with knives and shit.
Dangerous.
And sometimes they'll have
only in the most shallow.
Sometimes they'll have like delicate scars on their hand, which only accentuates their femininity, you know? And like the only way a woman, like the only way a strong woman could ever be desirable is also to be physically beautiful and perfect. With like perfectly formed, like pert high breasts and like flat stomach, and I get so tired of it. And so when like Kissin was like, no, yeah, no, I have scars all over my face, and I have like fiery, wiry, like flyaway red hair, and is completely unconcerned with her physical appearance. It's like, my body is a tool that I use to do what I need to do, and sometimes that's, a physical release, and sometimes that's killing a god with my bare hands, and I have the strength to do both.
Yeah.
And so when we meet her, she's flirting with a bar, like a barmaid. And we find out later, Kissin is fluid, so it doesn't really matter. Most people in this world, I feel, are fairly... I do love a, hey guys, this is a fantasy setting, which means we don't need to adhere to the like
the cultural norms of the society that produced the writer of this novel.
Yes. Yeah. We don't need to adhere to the cisgendered heterosexual normative culture that prevails in our reality, because this is an entirely different reality. So no one remarks on the fact that she both will have sex with a woman and a man and anything in between. No, it doesn't matter, because basically everybody is like that, because it's a world where that is very normal, and that is very just a part of society. And in fact, she prefers women because she doesn't have to worry about getting pregnant.
Right.
Like,
And we
cool.
Like, we cover great. A little bit later that like this whole culture kind of has like Planned Parenting.
Yeah.
Because you can talk to, you can literally go like have a chat with the fertility gods.
Yeah.
And then they can manage your situation.
Yeah.
To either help you get pregnant if you want to be pregnant or stay not pregnant if you don't want to get pregnant.
Right.
And so a lot of the constraints from reproductive,
eliminated.
I guess a lot of the societal constraints from reproductive consequences are not there because they can manage it.
In fact, in the second book, this isn't really a spoiler, we meet a trans character.
Okay.
And part of the reason that they are doing what they're doing in the book is because they were able to ask a god for help to confirm their gender expression.
Mm-hmm.
And they got that for free because they just had to pray and like provide offering. Like they just had to give the god a little and they got a little. But had they had to pay for the powders required to transition, they couldn't have done it. And so one of the reasons, because in this world, gods are illegal. Gods are outlawed in this country, this particular
just
country.
This country.
And that is because at a certain point, there was a city, Blen Raiden, and it was the city of gods. And there were tons of gods everywhere. And everybody partied with the gods and everybody hung out and had a great time. And then the gods kind of got into a bit of a tiff. And when they were done, all the humans in the city were dead. Including the entire royal family, except Black Sheep Aaron, who was off doing other things. So it's a very, what was the name of that television show where it was the designated survivor? Aaron was the designated survivor. Yeah, he was the one that was like, he's like the son who was the equivalent of like the cabinet minister over agriculture.
Right.
And literally everyone else died. And he was like, oh, God, I'm king. And so he was like, well, my first decree is to kill all the people that killed my family, which means kill all the gods. So they sacked their own city, the city of Blen Raiden, to destroy the gods that lived there and then outlawed gods, which is why Kissin the God Killer can now operate as an actual entity of the state.
Right. Oh, she's an independent agent.
Right. But she's sanctioned.
She's employed mostly by like government.
Yeah.
Government officials.
Right. Whereas before it was a very underhanded, God killers existed. People knew they existed. You could hire them, but it was like an action of last resort.
Right. And you'd only do it when a god kind of went crazy.
Yeah. When a god started demanding blood sacrifices and stuff or like this particular, the god that we meet her, she's defeating a god. And this god has started withholding like fertility from crops to try to get more prayers.
Yeah.
And so they are actively harming people in order to try to grow. And so that would be a moment where you would hire a god killer because like, oh, that god got too big for his britches. Let's go ahead and just take that guy out. And so that's how we meet her at first. And then we pick up Inara pretty quickly, too. And Inara is this little girl who has a god who is attached to her. So most gods have a shrine or shrines, kind of like churches. They have churches, but sometimes they're little, sometimes they're big.
Yeah.
And Skedi does not. He just has Inara. And Skedi is like a little jackrabbit with wings and horns. He has antler. He's like a jackalope. With wings. And he can be any size. So he can be small. He can be big. And he has a big name. His name is Skediseth. But we just call him Skedi. And he is the god of white lies, which at the beginning doesn't feel very useful. But by the end of the book, you're like, oh, shit, that's the most useful god power I've ever heard of in my entire life.
So helpful.
So helpful. And we also meet Elagast. And I love Elagast. I thought you would really like Elagast.
Yeah, I really like the Elagast character.
Yeah. Because he's a very, like, I did it, you know, I did the boy thing. I did the I'll be a man and I'll be a knight and I'll fight beside my bros. And then I realized that maybe that's not for me. And I think I'm just going to go bake bread.
Right. And then he was torn between his oath to follow his best friend growing up.
Yeah.
And now his king that he has sworn allegiance to.
Yeah.
It, and his like principles of like be a good person.
Yeah.
Because yeah. Now the king's kind of getting a little big for his britches, and which is a theme.
Yeah.
That power corrupts. And so he's like, sorry, king, I'm retiring.
Yeah.
from being your knight commander.
Yeah.
And I'm just gonna go off by myself.
I'm gonna go bake bread.
So he becomes a baker.
Yeah.
And so we pick him up in his bakery, and
I love all the descriptions of food.
Yes.
Yeah, oh my god, we describe food.
It feels like a Ghibli movie.
Yes. Yeah, like because there's a lot of sumptuous cozy descriptions of food.
The cozy slice of life anime food depictions.
Yeah.
We're getting that kind of vibe in here.
Yeah, it's kind of nice because otherwise this book is very relentless. And then every once in a while, it's like, we're going to sit down and we're going to have olives soaked in olive oil. And I'm going to make some focaccia on top of the fire. And I'm going to pull out my kneading mat and my flour and my yeast. And I'm going to tell you how I'm making this bread. And you're like, oh, thank you. Like, I needed a breather. I needed a minute. She's very good at giving us soft and fast.
Right. And that's kind of how Elagast, that's kind of his therapy. That's yeah. how he regulates his emotions. And so we get descriptions of what he's feeling.
Yeah.
Like, sensation-wise from his emotions and how the baking, kneading bread helps with that.
Right. Because he's got PTSD. He's sacked. Like, he killed a bunch of gods. He defeated the god of war. And when we pick up with him, we meet Aaron almost right away because Aaron sneaks into his bakery and he's like, sup, bro? Like, I knew you were tired or whatever, but, like, do you think I could get you to do, like, just this one tiniest little, just the idiot, like, the, just a tiny little favor?
Right. So that's the plot hook for Elagast.
Yeah. I need you to go to Blenraiden. Can you do that for me? That would be great. And the plot hook for Kissin is Inara, because she hooks up with Inara, finds out that Inara has this god, and because Kissin is anti-god, like very, God's fucked up my life, and I owe them nothing, and no one should owe them anything, and I'm going to help you get rid of this god that has attached himself to you.
Right, but she also rescues Inara after Inara's...
Right, well, like, Inara's whole family dies.
Right.
Her mom. It's really just her mom. Her family dies and then the whole building gets burned down.
Yeah, her, I guess her house. So there's like
yeah.
kind of royal houses. I'm not sure if they're all...
It's probably like dukes. Like Duke yeah. and Earl and Baron and but then King. So it's
her
like
her mother is Lady Crier.
Yeah. So Lady Crier.
House Crier.
Inara has left. She snuck out to go meet Kissin because she heard there was a god killer in the area. And she wants to figure out what Skedi is and why Skedi is attached to her. And Skedi wants to know too. And it's kind of cool that she has a bunch of powers because she's attached to Skedi. Like, she can see auras, what she calls them, people's colors.
Right.
And except Kissin's. Because Kissin
keeps... she keeps it so close.
Yeah.
She's so had mental training.
Right. So yeah, Kissin is really...
Because all the gods can see human emotions.
Kissin's really hooked in by Inara's general mystery. Who are you? Why does no one think that Lady Crier had a child? And then she does have a child with the child.
And the audacity of you to sneak out of your house to meet with a god killer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have Skedi. And oopsies, look, you don't have anywhere to go back to. So now you're with me. So let's fucking figure this out. And so they all travel to the city of
Lesha,
which is where Kissin now lives. So Kissin is actually from Blenraiden. And she has two friends that are from there as well. And that's Telly and Yatho. And Telly and Yatho are both are married. They're wives. And Telly is deaf. If you want to continue with our excellent disability representation, she's both deaf and scarred because they were like street children. They were beggars. And the lady, their mistress who was in charge of them, who took all of their begging earnings, basically, scarred her to make her more pathetic, which is kind of sad. Like, they have a really tragic backstory.
Yeah.
And then Yatho is both a blacksmith and she's in a wheelchair. And she's not always in a wheelchair, which I was like, chef's kiss, fucking perfect. Because, you know, not everyone who's in a wheelchair is in a wheelchair 100% of the time. Sometimes it is an assistant thing. It is not a I depend on this for my life thing. Mm-hmm. There are huge shades of dependency in terms of wheelchair users. And one of the things when people see people in a wheelchair and they're not, they don't have any experience with disability, is it's very black and white. Well, if you stand up, then you didn't need the wheelchair. Like, bitch, sometimes I need the wheelchair and sometimes I don't. And you don't get to decide that for me because guess what? It's not your body. And I feel like I have read so many fantasy novels where there is, if there's a person of color, it is a very, like, I check the box. Look, right, y'all.
It's a token right. Person of color.
And, like, Elagast is a person of color. And one of the few, like, we don't linger on it. It's just a part of the fabric of everything that's happening. We get a brief skin color description, and then we know his hair is, like, tightly coiled. Because he likes to keep it short. He doesn't like it long.
Yeah.
And so I just love, like...
So I think that's probably a basic introduction to the characters.
Right. But I'm just saying, and, like, I wanted to talk about the representation in this book is fabulous. Like, if you mm-hmm. read it for nothing else, read it for the representation.
I can dig that.
So, like, thank you. Yeah. And so I think right now we're going to head into spoiler land probably. So if you haven't read the book yet and we just sold you on the book, go read it and then come back, because here we go with the spoilers.
Hold on. There was one more...
Not yet. We're not going.
One more similar thing that I wanted to mention, which is a like short story that I've seen on the internet a few times called The God of Arepo.
Yeah.
And this feels very similar to that as far as the like you make a shrine, you pray at it and it will manifest a god.
Yeah.
And look it up, you know, Google it, read it, cry like I did. And then you can read this book.
I think I've read it and it's really sweet. It's very similar, but it's less dystopian. This is very dystopian. Yes. Yeah. Like, oh no, if I wish for something hard enough, I could literally make a god and then the god could lose their mind and hurt people. Like, you have to be careful about your intent. Yeah. So here we go into spoiler land. So pause and welcome back. Okay, now we're going to talk about everything that happens in this book, because I think it's really good. Because once we get everybody together, which does take a little while, and if I have a complaint about this book at all, it's that I am halfway through Sunbringer and I still don't know what the fuck is up with Inara.
Oh, really?
Like, okay, Hannah,
I haven't read Sunbringer yet.
Yeah, Hannah, please. There's mysteries, and then there's, you have left me hanging so long. I'm starting to feel frustrated. I need clues. I don't need the solution, but I need clues. And we're getting the clues in that we can see what she can do, but we're not getting the extent of what she can do.
Yeah. Gotcha. But it's like a third of the way through the book, they all hook up
in the Pilgrim train. Yeah, and then we really get going. Yeah. Because now we're all together. We're not switching POVs. We're switching POVs, but we're not switching plot lines. We're all on the same plot path. They're all traveling together. We just, like, now we're talking from Kissin's point of view. Now we're talking from Ello's point of view, which I love Ello and Kissin together because...
Yeah, it's a little bit of enemies to lovers.
Is it? I mean, at the end, I don't get the sense that they are, like, hot and heavy for each other. It's just
I would say they're hot and heavy for each other, but they're not, like, long-term, emotionally life-committed to each other.
Yeah, it's a very, I am complete unto myself, you are complete unto yourself. I think we would both enjoy a time where we travel in parallel lines. But right. My life is not now completely entangled in yours. And
exactly.
It's not a fated mate situation. Well, these mm-hmm. are not fated mates. These are two extremely competent, extremely physical people who have come together and have an attraction and act on it.
Right. They have a mutual respect and a physical attraction for each other.
Yeah.
And enough, like, openness to explore that.
Right. Yeah. And they do towards the end.
Right.
Where Kissin's like, all right, well, because we find out that Aaron, this was all a trick, because Aaron actually has the heart of a god, because when they were sacking Blenraiden and they were fighting the god of war managed to land a blow on Aaron that like cleaved his chest. And so Elo prayed that the god, like some god would save him, like, please come save him. And Hestra, the hearth god, took up residence in Aaron's chest.
And became his heart.
And I love how it's like a moss. It's like a nest of moss, yes, with a little, yes, flame, so inside of it.
The gash, like the split in his chest, is still there.
Yeah.
But it's like this twiggy bird nest.
Yeah.
With a little fire in it.
Yes. I love that imagery. It feels so druidic.
Yes.
It feels so... Yeah.
It feels magical.
Yeah, it feels magical.
And they don't cover it up. So you never get this impression that, oh yeah, the gods can affect the world in this way.
Yeah.
But... it becomes invisible.
No. He doesn't heal him. It replaces what he lost.
And there are probably gods out there who could have healed him.
Yeah.
But for this god, this is the way that this god could have...
it did what it could.
Kind of...
because it's just a little hearth god. Helped him along. It's right? Just a tiny little hearth god. Little fire god. And it's going out.
After a couple years.
Yeah, well, we think it's going out. Aaron tells him it's going out. It's been like 2 or 3 years. It's been, can't remember actually, less than 5. It's not been that long.
Right.
Yeah. And Elo has to travel to Blenraiden to make a deal with another god to take over for Hestra so that Aaron won't die.
And that's Elo's mission.
Cool, we'll do that then. And Kissin's going to try to figure out how to get Skedi away from Inara. And nobody is thrilled to be going to Blenraiden, but here we are. So they actually travel with pilgrims because pilgrimages are illegal. So they're like, they're going on a pilgrimage on the down low. They have to like contract with a sort of a shady individual.
They have to get smuggled, basically. Yeah. But there's a whole group, like there's still a whole section of the population. It's only been a few years, more than 2, less than 5, probably, since the ban. The pogrom on gods
was started,
put in place. And so most of the people that are still alive are like, I'm a secret practitioner of or follower of the god of whatever.
Yeah.
Or like the 20 gods that are my favorites out of the 5,000. and
my local favorites.
And so there's still a lot of people that want to go to Blenraiden with Blenraiden
or need to
Blenraiden with its reputation of there's even before the ban it was the city of the gods, and it was a combination of wild gods and like human produced gods and or like I guess city people produced gods.
I like the couple they travel with that are she was blessed with fertility and she didn't want it.
Barrick and Betsetter.
Yeah.
Betsetter is one. Barrick, I think, is the other.
Yeah. Well, she was blessed with fertility, but now the god of midwives is gone. And so she's concerned that if she has a child, she might die.
Right. Because she knows other people who had the same blessing as her, who every time they try to have a baby since this goddess was killed, their babies die.
Right. Or they die.
Right. And she wants this blessing removed.
Yeah.
So that because they want to have a baby.
Right.
And they don't want their baby or her to die.
Yeah. And that was like, okay. And he actually says, it's her body, it's her choice. I always like it when an author is overtly political. And I see that a lot as an overt political statement. Well, it is your body, so it's your choice. My body, my choice. Yeah, I like it. I mean, it takes us a while to get to Blenraiden, and we actually very quickly realize that something is happening, like something is attacking the party. Something is attacking the pilgrims. And like the first night it's 1, the next night it's 2, and then it's 4. And it takes us a while before we realize that somebody cursed Elagast.
Which takes a lot.
Yeah.
Like it's a big deal for a like human to put down a curse because of how devoted they are to their god.
Yeah.
Like they have to have a substantial connection with their god to channel that much energy.
Right.
To put curse, down a curse.
To direct a god. A god can curse anybody, but right. For a human to direct a god to curse somebody. And he has writing on his back that's slowly getting bigger.
And so curses grow over time.
His does, depending on the curse.
Right.
And this is how we kind of learn what Inara can do, because she removes the curse. It takes us a while, but she can unravel God and God's intent. She can unravel intent.
Right, which is, up until this point in this society, is impossible.
Right,
and humans can't do that. And then even gods, to be able to unravel another god's curse is like a real, real big deal.
Yeah.
But Inara can just kind of do it.
Right, and we meet An, who is a river god, a fairly powerful river god. And she calls her Little Weaver.
Or Little Unraveler?
Little Unraveler. And we still don't know why. Like halfway through the next book, I'm like a little pissed about it. But I liked that all the water gods are connected. Anything the water knows, they know, because the water cycle is all connected. It's right. Like, that's good. I like that.
Yeah.
And An appears as a giant naked woman, which Kissin is like, oh, she's doing that on purpose because she knows it distracts me. I love Kissin so much. It was just, I mean, I felt like when we got to the twist at the end, I was happy with it. Like, it was a good twist when we're like, nope, sorry, yes. Aaron has actually gone mad.
Yes, that was such a good twist.
And this is now Hesseth, and Hesseth will take over for Aaron. And like, it's okay, we're going to work together. Well, Hesseth just wants a foothold in the kingdom, next kingdom, because she's taken over Talisha. And so she wants Aaron's kingdom, and so she's going to get it through Hestra. And in order to become part of Aaron, Elo has to give up his life.
Yeah, so for gods to do things, they need a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess they need an offering.
They need an offering, yeah.
And
in Heseth's case.
And that grants power.
It's a life, yeah.
That grants power to the god that they can then use as like fuel.
Right.
To do stuff. And so as the god grows and they want to do more and more, that's why their demands for offerings can grow. And in the same way that humans are susceptible to becoming like corrupted or consumed by their like chasing of.
Yeah.
More, getting more, more,
and
more.
And it is like
a drug. So are the gods.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that's why we get that part where Skedi gets a coin. He gets paid and he's like, an offering. And he's yeah. like, and so then he like takes over Inara. That's when he takes over Inara's body.
Yep.
And he uses Inara to get Elagast away from Kissin because Kissin doesn't like Skedi.
Right.
And that's when Inara
away from.
Yeah. That's when we first realized that Inara can unravel god intent. And I think that was a good way to introduce her power and to introduce the almost like drug-like power that offerings have over mm-hmm. gods. Because Skedi is like, why did I do that? That is not, I would never do that, but I did that. And he's been atoning for it. He atones for it the whole rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, when Elo Elo is like, okay, if this is what it takes to save my king, then I'm gonna do it. And Kissin is like, not on my watch. She's like, no, thank you. So she challenges Hesseth, who is like the biggest fire god, and ends up drowning her in the ocean. Like
yes.
falling into yes, the through ocean a, with her.
Through a plausible fight scene with a like mad god.
Yeah.
She lures it to like tackle her. Lures Hesseth into
yeah, tackling her. Yeah, she sacrifices herself to defeat Hesseth yeah. because she knows a citizen has been waiting for his chance to hurt Hesseth, but can't because he's the ocean and Hesseth is fire.
Right, and so we find out part of the... Okay, so this was part of Skedeseth's origin story
yeah.
that I really liked. That was really like, oof. Hard on the feels. During the big battle in Blenraiden, when all the gods started fighting each other, which was, I think, instigated by some of the gods were, like, encroaching on the other gods' territory, and then eventually the gods started fighting other gods, and lots of collateral damage, like superheroes fighting in a city.
Yeah.
And so people evacuated from the city, and they're right on the water, so everybody got in boats and was getting out away from the city. And then an Ocitizen was protecting them.
Yeah.
But then Hesseth burned all the boats. And I think Hesseth and some other gods cooperated.
Yeah. And this burned all the boats. Skedi's like, you guys are going to be okay. Everything's going to be all right.
And so Skedi was with the people on the boats, like telling everyone and like the kids and boats, the white lies of, don't worry, it's all going to be okay.
It's going to be okay.
And then that's the last thing that, or I guess that's the only member that Skedi has recovered from before being bonded with Inara.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whew. I know.
So it was like, was that when Skedi was born? Like, because so many people in this convoy were all telling their kids, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Don't worry. This fire, whatever, we'll take care of it. And all that kind of combined energy, like, boop, Skedi was born in that. That's my hunch.
Yes. So the one thing I really like is when an author takes a unusual power. Like, it's one thing to have a character that has, like, my power is fire, and I have big fire power. Whoa, right. Fire. And you're like, oh, okay, that's fine, whatever. Okay, fire power. Mm-hmm. It's really way, way, way more fun when an author is like, my power is white lies. And at first you're like, white lies? What? And then, like, when they're trying to sneak in places, Skedi's like, you don't see anything. There's nobody over here. Oh, I don't matter. Don't even look. Just go back to what you're doing.
Yeah, or convincing like the person at this the sleeping establishment.
Yeah.
That, oh yeah, you believe our backstories.
Yeah. Oh no, that makes perfect sense. Doesn't it? It does, doesn't it? Just a harmless little lie.
Yeah.
But it pushes them through so much of the story. And even using it in that moment where it's like, these people are all going to die. They're on these boats that are on fire and there's no way they can't get out of this. And he's just giving them comfort by being like, this is going to be okay. You're going to be all right. Everything's going to be fine in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, masterstroke. That is perfect. It kind of reminds me of something from The Night Side where his power really is just finding things. And that's it. Like, he has one stunning power, which is to find things, anything.
In the Night Side, he can find anything.
Right. And he can't use it. So he's restricted to tricks and simple magic tricks, sleight of hand, real simple things. But the way that he uses it only makes people think he's just this really powerful character.
Right. Like, he has this one little, like, tiny spell, like, really easy to use a spell for, like, short range teleportation.
Of small things.
Of small things.
Yeah.
But the really, really hard part that requires other people to throw a lot of extra energy into it is you have to know the boundaries of the thing.
Yeah.
Exactly to be able to move it. And so other people that want to use this in a casual way will need a lot of empty space around the thing so that they only move that thing. But he can, like, peek open his eye a little bit.
His third eye.
His private eye.
His private eye.
and use that to, like, throw all the knowledge into all the information about the locations of things into his spells. And so he can do like really, really nuanced, fine-grained stuff with this spell that he uses regularly.
Yeah.
And, like, people show up and
he'll be like, how are you going to shoot me if there's no bullets in your gun?
And he'll just drop all the bullets from their guns out of his hands. And then,
yeah. And it's a very simple, small trick. It's not explosion. It's not fire. It's not God tier magical ability. It is just like this one small power in the hands of a creative character. And when an author puts that level of restriction on themselves and then really rises to the challenge, that is the most satisfying thing in a fantasy book. I like fantasy to have magic. I just read a fantasy book for Feast, Sheath, and Shatter, which is fantasy, but it's sort of like saying it's sci-fi because it doesn't take place on Earth. It's fantasy because it's just set in swords, no sorcery, like just swords and politics.
Yeah.
And like, okay. It's sort of like Game of Thrones is like that. The books are like that. There is some magic, but it's very obscure. It's not like a big... It's kind of like Star Wars and Andor, where Andor didn't have the Force or the Jedi or anything, whatever. And so I do like to have some magic in my fantasy is what I'm getting at here. But I like it when the magic is used differently. Like... We're done. Like I have enough. If I want a God tier magical ability person in my fantasy book, I got those. That's fine. I can get those. I can go pick one up right now. It's great. But can we all focus? Maybe can we all make a deal that we're going to focus from here on out with, like, I'm going to create creative uses for magic, like white lies or being able to find a thing or... Trying to think of another really good example where it's
Nicolas Cage in Next.
Yes. Yes. That's a really good one. He can see, like, 2 minutes into the future.
And he does so much with it.
And that's it. Just 2 minutes. But in the hands of a creative individual, look at what you can do with simply knowing how someone's going to answer your question.
Right.
And
are there any other ones? There's like a magic fantasy, urban fantasy series. Kind of like Harry Dresden meets Harry Potter in London.
Okay.
And there's a magical society. There's human society.
Is that the Magicians?
No, this one is Alex Varis.
Okay.
I think it's the Alex Varis series. And he's, I think it's like Oracle or whatever is like his kind of magic. But he, like in Next, he can look into the future. But he can go a little bit farther, but it branches. And so things get, the farther you look out, the less predictable things get. But he does similar things. Like at one point, someone's shooting at him with a sniper rifle, and he knows exactly when to dodge.
Right.
To get out of the way. But otherwise, that's the only magic he has.
Right. And like, good. Thank you. Yes. Because it... Otherwise,
the constraints give us the interesting stuff.
It makes the story interesting. You're not like, oh, how are they going to use their undefinable, illimitable power to get out of this thing, and somehow no one's going to die and everyone's going to be okay because fire, shit, whatever. Not that I'm referencing a specific book series or anything like that. I am. And if you don't know, you don't know. And if you do know, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So that's, I think, why I like this book, because she puts so many cool limitations on herself and then she really rises to the challenge. And she gives us such a cool, diverse, interesting, well thought out, well fleshed out cast of characters. A world that feels super rich, but is really painted in these really broad strokes, but yet feels extremely nuanced and detailed. Because when we do need to zoom in, she knows exactly how that city is different from other cities. Like, we go to that one city and they stay at like a Wayfarer's Tavern and you can pay, like, it's literally just hammocks over a waterfall, because the bridge is like a bridge city. And they only can have so many people in the city because the bridge can only support so many people. And so they limit the number of people that come in every day. Mm-hmm. And then when they stay at the inn, they're literally just hammocks strung across the bottom of the bridge. And you pay based on how far away from the waterfall you are.
Because the waterfall is noisy and wet.
Yeah, because it sprays you with water otherwise. And I was like, fucking thank you. That is so creative and interesting. Like, I love that. Like, it wasn't a, oh, this is the tavern and then the inn keeper is rude and there's watered down beer and the rooms are upstairs and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's fine. It's fine for what it is, but I also enjoy creativity. So I felt like this book was really creative. And
yeah, and narrative that's why wise, I really enjoyed it. Like, it's not that complicated, but the, because we have reasonable hooks for everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to go to Blenraiden. And the whole goal, I guess the two goals are, I need to ask a god to save my buddy Aaron and like keep his heart going. And I'm bonded with this god and we both want some autonomy.
Yeah.
And we just need someone to separate us.
Yeah.
And then we get there and we kind of get a twist on each of them because if Aaron is like tricking him into doing this.
Yeah.
But then Skedi kind of realizes, well, I don't want to stay here.
Yeah.
And I'd rather stay with Inara and let's figure out what we can do. And then Inara is like, I really like the character growth too.
Yes.
We get character development, not less on Elegast, because he has his backstory where he went through his emotional struggles.
Finding out what Elegast went through. Yeah.
And he's, I think, the biggest development for Elegast is breaking his allegiance, his friendship with Aaron by finding out that Aaron was just manipulating him the whole time.
Yeah. Well, it's and him so that coming frees to terms him
from
with,
a lot of constraints.
Yeah, it's him coming to terms with his role. Like, did him leaving Aaron cause Aaron to go crazy like that? Would he have prevented it had he been there? Should he have just walked away? Was that the right thing to do? Could he have been
an anchor for Aaron to not go off the track so much?
Yeah, was that the right thing to do?
A big part of Kissin's character is that she's so stubborn about a lot of things. Like, she has this blessing, and it's the last thing her father gave her, and it's literally written on her skin. And at the very end, she's like horribly burned from her battle with Heseth, and she's just sinking into the ocean after Ocidison has destroyed like this incarnation of Heseth.
Yeah.
And she's like, okay, I get to die now. And then she's like, wait, ugh, fucking Inara, I can't just leave her like that.
Yeah. God damn it, I got stuff to do.
And
I'll use my boon.
Like, fine, O citizen, like, save me. And so she loses that blessing that's like,
it's her father's life.
Right.
Yeah.
Literally her father's life energy bound into this mark on her chest.
Right.
And now she has to let that go. Kind of, and symbolically, it's like she's letting go of that to allow her to move forward to do new things.
Yeah, and I really like how the gods are portrayed. They're not people with powers. They are entirely alien. For example, we find out that Kissin's father gave his life for her, and so a citizen saved Kissin, but he didn't do anything with her. He just threw her up on the shore.
Right, he just short-term saved her.
Right. And so if she's mad because her dad gave his life to someone that he loved, which was Ocidison, to save his daughter, and Ocidison was like, oh, okay, cool, and just like threw her up on the shore. Well, it's because what gods do is not necessarily cruel so much as it is indifferent.
And right, they're just oblivious.
A lack of understanding of what you... Not every god fully understands what it means to help a human. Like, right. He did exactly what Kissin's dad asked him to do. He saved her. Like, she's fine. Look, she's alive, isn't she? I saved her. And he gave her the boon, which was her father's life, that she could use anytime.
Right.
And she finally uses it. And I love the ending, because even had she died in that moment, like, had she not had a way to come back, it would have all felt like it had meaning. Like, I wouldn't have been like, fucking seriously? Because sometimes to sort of create artificial conflict or create artificial emotion, like as an emotional bid, as an author, they will put a character in like dire straits, like almost kill them off. And it's supposed to be like, oh no, I'm so sad. They almost died. They almost gave their life, or they did give their life, or whatever. And the last several books that I've read that have ended that way, it all felt so contrived. It just felt like I'm doing this because I know it's going to make a certain percentage of my readers real, real sad. And they're going to love it because they like to be sad. And this felt like, oh, there was nothing else she could have done. And then when Ello and Inara leave and they go and find Legs, her horse.
Yep.
And the horse is just waiting. And they're like, sorry, she's not coming back. And they think she's dead for a good portion of the next book, too. And it's just like, oh, it's so good. It's so well done. It makes so much sense. You never felt like it was leading there. But then once it does, you're like, oh, of course. Like, yeah. To get revenge, I completely believe Kissin would give her life to get revenge on Hiseth.
Yeah. And then Batsetter and the other B name show back up and are like, oh, hey, you guys need a ride? Here, have our horses.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Thanks for explaining what I was doing wrong with my dough.
Yes. Yeah, you fixed my dumplings.
Yes.
Yeah, because he's like, they're getting in a boat. They're like pushing off this boat to try to escape these shadow monsters. And Ello is like, you're boiling your dumplings too hot. The water's too hot. That's why they're sticky. He's like, what? Is this the moment? And he's like, yeah, there's no better moment than right now. That's why your dumplings are sticky. And so he saved his dumplings. This book, I felt like there was no wasted space in this book. I felt like everything felt like it made sense. Everything felt like there were a couple moments where I was like, I don't believe that character would be that incurious, but okay. Like when they're meeting up with Canavan to hook up with the pilgrims and there's blood on his arm. There's blood on Canavan's arm. Okay. And Inara's like, oh, you got blood on you. And he's like, oh, I must have cut myself. And it's the blood he gave to the guy, but it's okay. Like, it's fine. It was just
I would say, as a man who does things with tools a lot.
Yeah.
And
but you don't live in a world with blood sacrifices.
Can be fairly oblivious. It is a regular occurrence.
Yeah, but you don't
for
live,
me to you like, don't live take in a break a world and be like, oh, I cut sacrifice. Myself. There's blood on my arm.
Yeah, but in this world, that could be significant.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be like if you came up from doing a task and you had blood on you, but we also had a family god that sometimes you could give a drop of blood to and they'd do stuff. I might wonder, did you ask for something?
Mm-hmm.
But it's fine. It's fine. Even those moments are like, okay, you know what? Everybody's not on it all the time. They're all distracted. They're all worried about going to Blenraiden. And I totally get being completely wrapped up in your task. So, okay. And it was so refreshing to read a book where I felt like the author was extremely intentional about everything that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And go read this book. I hope you read it already.
It also ends with a really good setup for
the next book. So much so that you're like, ooh, I'm ready. Let's read it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Inara, who I forget how old Inara is.
I don't know that we really
older
cover
than
it.
10, probably.
Yeah.
Just based on the fact that she can like shoot a big bow.
Yeah.
Like she can shoot a big enough bow to kill people and do it well because her mother trained her to do that. We find out like her mother was kind of training her with some useful skills, but hadn't like explained the whole
thing. I
want to
find out more about her mother because there's a secret there. And
yeah. So at the end, Inara's like, well, I guess now I'm fucking Lady Crier and I'm going to find the resistance and I'm going to work with the resistance and take down this stupid fucking king.
Yeah. And it left me caring a lot about this world.
And Ello's like, I got you.
And the adults act like adults and the kids act like kids.
Yeah.
Fucking thank you. I know that feels like a really low bar, but honestly, I have seen authors not meet it. So like, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This never felt YA. There was not a moment where this felt YA. Right. And I feel like there's a lot of fantasy books right now that even if they're published as adult books, we're still trying to hit that YA tone. Mm-hmm. And we don't. She was like, fuck YA. This is not what this is. This is an adult book for adult fantasy readers. And thank you. As a very adult person who is knocking on 40's door, I don't want to read about 17-year-olds anymore. I mean, I will occasionally, but like, I also want to be able to read a book where I'm like, oh, this woman has lived. Kissin has lived. Kissin has lived a life. Kissin has gone through shit and survived, and Kissin is a survivor. And I loved that character so much. So much. I have literally read a book where the lady was an assassin who never kills anybody.
But she was the best assassin in the world. But she was the
best assassin in the world. I mean, she kills people, but she kills like soldiers. Like, they don't matter. Like, not the cool people. And it just, and then to read a book where like, I felt like Kissin, I really identified strongly with Kissin because I felt like she was both feminine, but also like when she needed to set that aside and just be like, okay, today I am just the god killer and I'm about to go fuck some shit up. And then she did. And I was like, I love that so much. Like, I just, and I think that's why I connected so strongly with this book because,
as a hyper competent woman,
I want an adult. Sometimes I want to read a book that's an adult book, but not an adult book in that everybody wants to fuck each other all the time. And we do fuck each other, like graphically on the page. I wanted a book where the characters felt like, you know, I have gone through a lot in my life. We have gone through a lot together. And then sometimes when you read books about characters that are like, I'm going through it, and it feels like the simplest, dumbest thing that anyone's ever gone through, you're like, okay, though, like, is it that bad?
Yeah, it's unusual to find a female character who's like a hyper competent woman.
Yeah.
Who also sometimes just wants to bang a guy that she has mutual respect for.
Right. And she's stubborn, but she is not stubborn to the point of stupidity.
Right.
Like, she's stubborn and then it's like, I think I'm right. And then when someone's like, I don't think you are, here's the evidence. She's like, fuck. You're right.
I'm angry.
You're right. You're right.
I accept it.
I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she can't read.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's minimally literate.
Yeah. And yet still has, she has a very worldly intelligence.
Yeah.
She understands the way things work. And even if she doesn't, and if she doesn't like it, she doesn't go with it. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed the character right, so much. I just loved it. It was so refreshing to read an adult
as a reference
woman.
To the, like, diversity representation. I was half expecting when they were like, "Oh yeah, she can't read." I was expecting them to pull out like, "Oh, it's because she's dyslexic."
Yeah, well, it could still be.
It could be that.
Yeah,
but not everybody is illiterate because they're dyslexic. I felt like that would have been a plot device-y usage
of a
disability.
Like, yeah.
Whereas it's her backstory. She grew up an orphan, like working for this lady begging on the streets.
Yeah.
And then she never got educated.
Yeah, she got out. She bullied her way into becoming the apprentice of a god killer, and then she came back and got her friends out.
Right.
Yeah.
And so she just never had the time for a formal education, like how to read. So she can like read like a few things. She can have a piece of like the wanted poster or something for a god, right? She can read that like assignment, but she wouldn't like read a book.
Right. Yeah.
That would be beyond her.
Yeah. And we see even more in the next book how she uses her appearance of stubbornness to her advantage. Mm-hmm. The fact that she appears hard and super competent and like she doesn't listen to anyone, she actually uses that as a tool. And the fact that someone actually managed to write a strong, intelligent character like Kissin is like, I can't even tell you how wonderful it was to read a character like this. Because there's a section in the next book where she's talking to a god And she is using her reputation of stubbornness to deliberately provoke this god to get it to tell her things it wouldn't tell her otherwise, to piss it off so it will, like, reveal information. And then finally it stops and it's like, you're doing this on purpose, aren't you? And she just smiles at it. And I was like, fucking thank you. Like, it's so, I know I've said this, but honestly, I can't say it enough. Like, women are not either feminine and soft and manipulative only in, like, a sexually manipulative way, and or stubborn to the point of stupidity, but also feminine and soft and pretty. Like, there is a wide variety of women out there. Just like men are not all 7 foot tall dudes with, like, a third leg for a dick. Like, maybe I need to branch out. Maybe these books are out there and I'm missing them, but they're real, real hidden if they are. So maybe we need to just, like, if you've got a recommendation for a book like God Killer, I'll take it, because it was so nice to read this. And I think we're just going to leave it there, because I think we've been glowing enough about God Killer, and I'm really excited. Like, maybe we'll read Sunbringer and talk about that too.
Yeah, I think so. I'm down for that.
Like, we might actually continue, because we've started a couple of series in our book clubs, and both of them we were like, no, it's fine. I don't really care where that's going, but I care where this is going. So, yeah, I think we're going to do Sunbringer, not next, because next, I think, is Creatures of Light and Darkness. Let me look up what's next.
That sounds right.
Another classic sci-fi.
If anyone's looking for a fantasy series about assassins with magic.
No, Planet of the Apes is next.
Oh.
Okay, assassins with magic.
But on your commentary on the assassin.
Yeah.
The Way of Shadows by Brent Weeks is about this kid. Would it be classified as young adult? It might be classified as young adult, but there's a lot of adult characters around them. But its depiction of being an assassin is much more dark.
You mean they actually assassinate people?
Like, they actually assassinate people. But the, like, assassin this guy gets apprenticed to is, he has principles. And, yeah. So, like, there's not any huge compromise of a character's, like, ethical principles. It's just, you know, this is a hard thing. You have to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And doing it will hurt you psychologically. And then there's the whole, you know, kind of magic aspect. But I really like that series.
Good. Yeah. You mean adults being adults?
Yes.
Like, and, yeah.
There's consequences to your actions.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not mad at YA. YA is fine. It's fine. If you like YA, that's fine. I personally cannot read, have not been able to find a book, YA book series that I connected with. And I feel like the YA tone, the YA feel has bled so much into the more adult range of books that I don't like finding. It's like stepping in something. Like, oh, gross. I thought this was fine, but it turns out it was not mud. It was poop, you know? Like,
yeah.
Not poop, literally, but. And you're like, no, not here. Don't do that. And, like, a lot of, like, the book, one of my favorite books, Sunshine by Robin McKinley, actually just got reclassified as YA, which I don't agree with. And then some books that started out YA have been moved up to more adult books because it's still YA in tone, but now there's spice. And I have conflicted feelings about it. So if you do too, this book is not that. This book is good. This book is adult. This book is not YA, and you should read it. And
I concur.
Leave it there.
So until next time, remember that sometimes the strangest things are the most beautiful too.
So be who you are and love what you love. Until next time, friends.
Bye.
Bye.